Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World interview recorded on the 9th of November, 2021. I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Jeremy McEwan, who's worked in the UK equity markets for decades, and during COVID wrote a paper on key themes for investors to consider, some of which we cover here, along with his exciting new podcast project, In the Company of Mavericks. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Can you tell us a bit about your background?
Sure. Well, I started out working in the UK market as a buy-side analyst in the early 1980s. All happened a bit by chance, really. I'd unusually gone to university in the US and returned in 1982, having missed the normal milk round of recruitment for UK universities. I'd studied economics and business administration and didn't really have much idea what I wanted to do. I had a vague idea I'd do something for a few years and then go and do a master's degree. So anyway, I started applying for jobs. I was told by lots of people at that time, I was crazy. Why did I come back to the UK? We're in a recession. You'll never get a job. I think partly because I had a slightly different story to tell. I was interviewed for a number of jobs and ended up, anyway, taking a job with South Yorkshire County Council Pension Fund in Barnsley, South Yorkshire, working as a trainee investment analyst. They paid me the sum of £7,000 a year. And my mum was very pleased because I'd chosen a nice steady job with the council. And all I can remember of that stage really is just one hell of a culture shock. I'd been living as a student for 4 years in Atlanta, Georgia. And I ended up in the middle of winter in the gritty industrial landscape of South Yorkshire. But in that job, I learned two things very quickly. And the first was that financial markets, investing in equities, fund management were able to become all-consuming. And they did for me. And second, if you wanted to be part of it, you had to be where it all happened. And that was either London, New York, or possibly Hong Kong in those days. So after a couple of years, I moved to London. And I guess reflecting on that period, that sort of journey, I suppose, it was a really fascinating time. I'd left the UK to go to university in the late 1970s. I was sort of, I think I was sufficiently economically literate at that time to know a bit about what was going on. You know, we'd had recessions, we'd had oil price spikes, we were living through inflation, and we'd had a political fallout from all these events. And I'd left the UK with a pretty conventional view of the world, sort of how the liberal progressive ideas about how the world works, or maybe how the world should work. But I returned 4 years later with, I guess, a bit giddy really on the ideas of economic individualism and supply side economics. And, you know, it was the time when these sort of ideas that were being espoused by Milton Friedman and Hayek were being put into political effect. And it was sort of experimental days of the Reagan and Thatcher administrations. There were periods of deregulation, of tax reforms in the US and privatizations, and just the rolling back of the state. And, you know, by the end of that decade, you know, not that many years later, the Berlin Wall collapsed, the Soviet Union imploded, and it seemed, as was described at the time, like it was possibly the end of history, that the West had won, and, you know, that's how it felt. But little did we realize then how sort of rather hubristic that all sounds today. So yes, going back, I had a number of jobs on the buy side. I came down to London, but I think my future was really determined in many ways by the impact of the stock market crash in October 1987. And I ended up, after a period of change, taking a job as an equity salesman at a Liverpool-based broker called Tilney & Company. And this was just after the Big Bang deregulation of the stock market, part of the Thatcher supply-side revolution. And Tilney, like many small brokers, had just been acquired by a merchant bank. In our case, it was a company called Charterhouse Jaffet. They were opening a London office, and I thought, after the turmoil of October 1987, I thought it would be a good place to park myself for a couple of years before I got back into fund management. And I was there for 13 years. And the thing that kept me there was the opportunity to work with some really good people to develop part of a team that grew from a very unlikely beginning to become, by the end of the 1990s, regarded and ranked as the number one small cap broker in the London market.
Wow. So as you allude to, you've seen loads of economic change. What are your views now on quantitative easing and the current monetary policy?
Wow. Yeah, where to start? So I think looking back at that, my life to date, there are three discernible eras of economic policy. And I've described the advent of monetarism and the supply side times of Reagan and Thatcher. But, you know, prior to that, we were living in the post-World War II Keynesian order. It was superseded by monetarism. And I think that was then subsequently superseded by what I'd term as central bank orthodoxy. And that, I think, happened sometime at the turn of the millennium. So the first era came to an end in the UK with the winter of discontent, the end of prices and incomes policies, and the sort of interventionist industrial policies of Wilson, Heath and Callaghan. And the monetarist era was then characterized by the defeat of inflation in the early 1980s, you know, the infamous Paul Volcker spike in interest rates and the supply side reforms that I've already referred to. So the third era, I think, is one that we might just be in the dying days of, is the one that I would refer to as the era of central bank orthodoxy. And it's this era that I think has become characterized by this previously unheard of policy called quantitative easing. And I think this became first visible with the bailout of LTCM, long-term capital management, in 1998. And this was the first time that I think financial market participants benefited from the knowledge that there was a thing called the Fed put. And that piece of knowledge, that piece of information, that action taken by financial market regulators and central banks in 1998, I think has resulted in the last 20 years of monetary policy make-do and mess that we find ourselves in today. And really, quantitative easing has evolved out of, as we all know, the financial crisis in 2008-09 and was famously put on the map by Mario Draghi in his comment about whatever it takes to hold the euro together. And it seemed to work. I mean, it did work. Bond yields declined. The Greek and the Club Med economies were reined in. But you have to ask yourself, you know, what have been the consequences of this? And to my mind, the answer is not only did it bail out insolvent and reckless bankers, it's inflated asset prices, creating what the Spectator, I think, brilliantly recently described as the assetocracy. And we're now in a world of free money, the financial moral hazard, where savers are incentivized to seek increased risk in order to find a real return on their capital, while at the same time, they're safe in the knowledge, or I think they are, they believe they are, that if it all goes wrong, the central bank, the government, the taxpayer, well, they'd be there to bail them out. And this plays havoc with the notion of pricing and relative pricing and the importance of price discovery in the guts, in the mechanism of financial markets. And I think this is what's also, incidentally, you know, created massive inequality in our societies and a justifiable sense of anger and frustration on people who either don't own assets or feel they don't own enough assets. And you know, we've all seen the political consequences of that. But in terms of, you know, bringing it back, I suppose, to the financial economy and financial markets, I think the other important thing this policy has done is effectively neuter the industry that I worked most of my life for, you know, the banking industry, in the way it's layered on regulation. And I don't want to be sort of get political about it, but it's the consequence of this policy is that it's prevented banks, it's neutered them and prevented them from doing what they should be doing. And that's providing credit for productive economic activity. And that has been lost in this process. And it's shackled and tied the banking industry to the political process. And as an aside, one of the interesting features of the market today is the rise of fintech these alternative lenders and payments companies. You know, I think a rule of thumb for anyone out there considering investing in or launching a business venture and your main competition are high street banks, then do it because you are pushing on an open door. These businesses are completely shackled by regulation. It makes them totally unresponsive to the requirements of their customers. And I can point to numerous examples, I'm sure you can too, of how the pandemic has accelerated this, you know, the digitization of our world. But this acceleration includes money, payments, and banking. And I mean, it's a whole new area, but I just think that this is putting increasing pressure on this era of central bank orthodoxy. It's hamstrung the banking industry, and that whole monetary system is no longer playing where the puck is or where the puck's going. And I think that it's being left behind by other forms of innovation in the financial world. How it's going to play out, I've no idea. It's going to get, I'm fascinated by it. But in many ways, that's why when I, during lockdown, when I started writing and I guess ranting about my thoughts of what's going on in the world, I called my blog Hypernormal Times. I borrowed the idea from a guy called Adam Curtis, who's a brilliant documentary maker. And he had a series called Hypernormalization. And he talked about what happens in a hypernormalized world. And the term was first used to describe the dying days of the Soviet Union. And the strap line is, they know, we know, they lie. Where everyone in the regime just knew it wasn't working, but no one, virtually no one, could afford to say so. And I think in many ways that characterizes the world we live in today in terms of banking and finance. So I think we're probably at the end of an era. What comes next? I don't know. I think it's fascinating. But I think what is certain is that this threat of change, this, I think, probably inevitability of change, because we can't go on as we are, it just heightens the prospect of what I would refer to as radical uncertainty around our monetary system. And I think it's something that investors need to be aware of when they're operating in today's markets.
That all sounds quite scary. I've seen Hypernormalization, which is brilliant. And it sounds a very scary future. But you've taken away the question I was going to ask, which was, how do you see it playing out from here, which you're suggesting you don't really know. But we do know that we're facing inflation, and that might be something that you do have a view on and how that will play out.
Yeah, I mean, just on that point on hypernormalization, I don't know if you saw the dramatization of Chernobyl in the TV series last year, but I think that brilliantly portrayed, you know, the Soviet era of hypernormalization. But I digress.
I didn't see that. I just saw the Adam Curtis hypernormalization.
I mean, if you think my blog's scary, the dramatization of Chernobyl is absolutely, will give you is the stuff of nightmares.
Anyway, your views on inflation.
Sorry. Yeah. It's a complex subject, and I've been talking about it a lot since April last year. And I guess as someone who remembers the 1970s, I've sort of felt, I guess, a bit of a responsibility to point out to people or to remind people what it can be like. And by way of reference, you know, in the decade from 1970 to 1980, the average UK house price went from £5,000 to £25,000. Yeah. The price of gold went from $38 an ounce to $600 an ounce. Mm. That's 15-fold. The price of a barrel of oil, $2 to over $100. That's 50-fold.
Yeah.
You know, the lesson is that things that were in relatively fixed supply fared very well. You know, the 5-fold increase in house prices sounds great, but only just about performed in line with the inflationary effect, the debasement of the currency over that whole decade. Obviously, gold, oil, both did significantly better. But by any measure, that level of price inflation, that level of inflation, monetary inflation, cost push inflation, stagflation, whatever you want to call it, is painful and cancerous and very damaging and harmful. And subsequent to that period, you know, I was born in 1960. The reality is that in my lifetime, every major currency with the possible exception of the Swiss franc, has lost over 90%, 90, of its purchasing power in my lifetime.
Goodness.
Yet we're told today, and most of us believe it to be the case, that we've been living in a period of benign inflation. You know, the idea that we've been fed that there is a certain amount of good inflation in our monetary system, I think, is a form of Orwellian doublespeak. Just been rereading 1984, and Orwell knew a few things very well. But to come back to your question about inflation, the answer is, what kind of inflationary environment is ahead of us? I'm afraid I don't know. It's a complex subject, as I said, and it's our inflationary figure, our inflationary environment is the net result of positive or negative forces, inflationary and deflationary forces, stating the obvious. What I think we've seen year to date, because certainly if you Google the term, you do the Google search on the term inflation or stagflation, it's the highest it's been for over a decade. People are seeing it, worried about it, wanting to find out about it. What we've seen to date is quite possibly just a series of opening up bottlenecks resulting in supply constraints and relative price shocks. One interesting anecdote here is the case of lumber prices. Lumber prices were on the front pages of the paper for a number of weeks in the first quarter of this year. It was the poster child of our impending inflationary spiral. We had too few houses, too few lumber treatment works, too few sawmills. This was a structural, permanent shortage. And, although I can't claim to have been a long-term follower of the lumber price over the years, if you do look at the price chart, a very good price for a ton of lumber over the last 25 years is about $400. In April this year, it reached $1,750 a ton and was universally held out as evidence of this inevitable pending inflation and it predicating quite a significant jump in bond yields. 6 months on, what's happened? Well, the price bottomed out at $400 in June this year and currently trades at a little over $600 a ton. So over the long term, it's an elevated level for lumber, but this is not necessarily an inflationary price spiral. And I think that anecdote plays itself out in other markets. It just takes, the supply chain cycle, the supply cycle for semiconductors is years, maybe decades, whereas for sawmills and lumber yards, it's a matter of a few weeks. But the more I've read about inflation and I guess more considered it, although the 1970s was definitely the last period of heightened inflation, and I think we are about to enter a period where inflation is clearly more front of mind, I don't think necessarily the 1970s is the closest analogue, the most similar period in our modern history to compare our current times with. And I think like a few other people, and Lynn Alden, I think, is very good on this subject, we probably need to go back a bit further and revisit the 1940s and 1950s to see the closest analogue. And like that time, governments were faced with spending and borrowing commitments that were, I always get this word wrong, that were life-threatening in nature. I mean, the COVID pandemic was a non-discretionary item in the mind of governments to spend money on and to borrow money, just like fighting a war. If the playbook is the 1940s for where we are today, what you need to consider is what Russell Napier and a few other people call the policy of financial repression. And put simply, that's the policy of allowing inflation to run hot, but not allowing interest rates to go up accordingly. And this deliberately taxes anyone who holds risk-free assets or deposit accounts. It also requires ultimately the greatest and more centralized control of access to credit. Now, obviously, history doesn't repeat itself. We're not going to go back and live in the 1940s. I don't see how we can return to the times of foreign exchange controls. But I do think it's informative to realise that the controls on capital flows out of the UK that were introduced in the early 1940s were not repealed until the late 1970s. I mean, I can remember them. I think the lesson here is this period of financial repression can last for decades. And in I think to put that in context, if that is right, you know, who knows, that the bubbles that we're seeing in our financial markets today and being reported on as being things to worry about, you know, Tesla shares, meme stocks, cryptocurrencies, quite possibly we're just in the formative stages of these bubbles.
So if you do have savings, say your pension or your ISA, where do you think is a good place to put your money? Because you're certainly not going to earn very much in the bank or in very safe havens. What asset classes do you favour in this environment?
I think in most scenarios for the foreseeable future, I think equities will remain a great place to invest. And I'm guilty here. I mean, what's the saying? If you give a man a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You know, I've been in the equity market for so long, it seems the natural place to be. But I think we're in an elongated bull market. And in the words of Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative. The policy of financial repression that I was talking about is forcing capital to take more risk. And we have started to see, well, we're in a period where the risk-free rate has been replaced with rate-free risk, by which I mean by holding risk-free assets, you're guaranteed to lose purchasing power. And how do we measure some of this? Well, I believe there's still today approximately $17 trillion worth of bonds held that are yielding negative real returns, real yields to redemption. $17 trillion. Goodness. So the owners of these assets are guaranteed to lose money. This, to my mind, is hypernormal. So what happens to these assets? Well, slowly but surely, you know, gravitational forces act on financial assets. And earlier this year, there was one of the Bank of America surveys saying that the global flows into equities in 2021 is on track. This was some months ago. I don't think it's changed dramatically. But so far, year to date, 2021, the global flows into equities is on track to exceed the aggregate amount of flows into equities over the last 20 years.
Gosh.
Now, it doesn't mean that's right. It doesn't mean that everyone who's part of this journey on this flow will make a risk-adjusted return from this trade. But I would argue it's too big to ignore.
And doesn't it get scary when it goes in the opposite direction if money gets pulled out?
Well, yes, of course. And, you know, I think that's why you need diversification. You know, I think that you're talking there about, you know, chaotic markets that result from and lead to sort of heightened radical uncertainty that you see at these points of significant change. I'd say 74 was one of them, maybe 87 was, certainly 2008-9 was. And, you know, I think one has to be sensible, balanced, and to preserve capital, to preserve wealth, you need to have a degree of diversification. So what do you do in that scenario? I don't think you need to own bonds, but I think you do need to own some real assets or have exposure to real assets. So things like gold, cryptocurrencies, Rolex watches, fine wine, vintage cars, collectibles, whatever you are familiar with or feel comfortable with. I have a number of these things. One exposure I have, I own some single barrel Scotch malt whiskey, which I enjoy drinking, but I think could become a very interesting store of value as well.
And cryptocurrencies, are you invested there?
Yeah, about 16 months ago, I invested in Bitcoin. And I did that. I had exposure to gold. And I view my holdings in these areas as insurance policies, because the world is uncertain, unknowable. And I think one needs to be, in times of extreme uncertainty, I think you need to hedge your bets, take insurance, buy insurance. So I have a small proportion of my net worth invested in Bitcoin and in gold.
Well, I could ask you a whole load of things about Bitcoin, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole at the moment. Coming back to equities, in the environment that we're in, what characteristics are you looking for in the companies that you're investing in?
I think the first important thing to say is that owning an equity, any equity, it's important, probably more important to decide why you're owning it or want to own it, and then to hold that position ideally forever or until you determine that the characteristics of that equity no longer meet your criteria, than it is actually what those criteria are. I suspect we'll come on and talk about different styles of investment later on, but in my time, I've dealt with a whole range of investors from working on the sales side with different styles. And I think one of the really striking things is that the important determinant of success is the degree of conviction that an investor has for their strategy, necessarily than that what that strategy is. You know, so to make the point, you know, Warren Buffett is the world's most renowned investor, but it's not because of the superior returns he's achieved year in, year out, impressive as those are. It's the period of time that he's owned his portfolio. You know, he started when he was a teenager and he's now nearly 100 years old. Duration really matters. And for that, you need to hold your nerve during big drawdowns. And to have that ability, the psychological ability to do that, you need conviction. So you need to be able to have a strategy to stick to. So I think that's sort of maybe an obvious, but I think it's an important point. So for me, the criteria that I look for are pricing power, cash conversion, and what I would describe as an owner's mindset. Pricing power, I think, is the polite term for a business's monopoly status. You know, economic theory would suggest that excess returns get competed away over time, but the ability to defend market position via a patent, some form of brand, a know-how, or scale effects all help build a defensive moat around a business and defend against that prevailing competitive pressure. So understanding how these moats operate and how effective they are at allowing pricing power to persist is a key component in making an equity investment, in my opinion. And I think the best indicator that a business has pricing power is a high and sustainable level of gross margin. Things that happen below the cost of goods line in an income statement are important, and in particular, the amount of profit that is turned into free cash. But it's the gross markup on a company's direct inputs that is the vital sign that creates value. I guess it's not surprising that companies with high gross margins with these type of characteristics seem to predominate in certain knowledge-intensive sectors such as technology, media, communications, software. But pricing power matters because it delivers returns that give the best prospects to beating the impact of inflation. But it also increases the likelihood that the company can return cash back to its balance sheet. And if this is matched with a high return on equity, low levels of capital employed, attractive working capital dynamics, and so on, then we have the critical ingredients for a serially compounding equity with a high reinvestment rate. And that's what I would consider to be the sort of the gold standard of equity investment.
In your paper, you discuss innovation. So where do you see innovation at the moment, both in any sector and company specific?
I think about innovation as ongoing and cumulative. And I think innovation specifically can be characterized either as a product innovation or as a process innovation, and both are important. So a product innovation is something like the Google search engine. It's a long time ago. I'm not sure if you can remember it, but I can certainly remember quite clearly the first time I used the Google search engine. It changed the world. And 25 years later, as Alphabet, it's still growing faster than most businesses that are a fraction of its size. This type of innovation is uncommon, it's very difficult, and it's fraught with problems. But as Ben Horowitz said, innovation is almost insane by definition. You know, most people view a truly innovative idea as stupid, because if it was a good idea, somebody would already have done it. So the innovator is guaranteed to have more natural initial detractors than followers. So these are very important, but they're not necessary. You know, I didn't invest in Google when Larry and Sergey first came up with the idea. I did it probably a couple of decades later or 15 years later, but the return is still accumulating. The second type of innovation is process innovation. So think of Southwest Airlines or Ryanair and their growth based on low cost, on the low cost airline model, or Jonathan Milner, who was the founder of Abcam, a brilliant AIM-listed business, solving for his problems of finding reliable and replicable antibodies for his biochemical research projects. Yet innovation is based on shared knowledge, open data systems, and practical trial and error. Small but persistent application of innovative techniques can deliver very significant business advantage in sometimes the most unlikely settings. You know, so an investment process that seeks out these hidden opportunities in unlikely places will often yield greater value than maybe hunting around for the next Google. So, yeah, I mean, Google is my largest single holding, obviously now called Alphabet. I've owned it for over a decade. And about 4 years after I bought it, they acquired a London-based startup called DeepMind, which they acquired for, I think, something like $500 million. It's a lot of money for a group of people with no revenue. But it's an example of optionality. And I think it's a valuable, instructive to think about. Yeah, as I said, it was a collection of some of the foremost thinkers and developers in the area of artificial intelligence on planet Earth. But Google today owns that business for free. And the reason they own that for free is because one of the very early projects the DeepMind team were asked to tackle was to apply their AI on the tricky problem that Google had in terms of managing its electricity consumption in its enormous industrial scale data centers. And in the relatively short period of time that DeepMind have been working on this, they've saved more than $500 million just in their energy bill. So the team that bought us AlphaGo, then AlphaFold, and is literally last week launched a new business called Isomorphic Labs, which is going to use its technology to completely reinvent the pharmaceutical industry. Alphabet owns that for free. So as an Alphabet shareholder, will DeepMind go on and be a real winner? Well, in one sense, I'm not really that bothered, but it has this long-term optionality on something that could be life-changing for a second time. So that's an example of the way I think about innovation as it relates to a big tech company. But for maybe a more down-to-earth example, process innovation that I really like in the AIM market, and I've spoken about it before, is an exchange services business called Aquis Exchange. Now, Aquis is a core business. It's a trading venue. It's the world's first and I think only subscription-based stock market. It's offering its investment banking and brokerage customers a marginal cost of zero to trade. Its model is similar to a telco. And the stock exchange is just a network and prices are message traffic. And what it's done is collapsed the cost to trade for its customers. And it's introduced, just like the low-cost airlines did with the legacy operators, it's been steadily winning market share. And the really interesting thing is the legacy incumbent operators, just like the airlines, they can't compete. They can't match what Aquis does without cannibalizing their own business. So it's enduring. And the other great thing about innovation, and you get this from talking to lots of small businesses on AIM, Alistair Haynes of Aquis is a great case in point. It develops a spirit of insurgency. It's what Peter Thiel described as giving such companies a cult-like status. And this cult-like status and this power of insurgency binds people together because they know something about the world that the rest of us don't know yet. And in Peter Thiel's case, you know, can you imagine what the early days of PayPal must have been like? There was Reid Hoffman, Peter Thiel, and Elon Musk all operating in the same startup. You know, can you imagine the strength of the glue to keep those egos together? You know, and it was because they all knew something that we didn't, and that one day we'd be happy to pay for things via an app that's embedded on a website. And, you know, that is now commonly understood and we all do it every day. And PayPal, you know, is worth hundreds of billions. So innovation is vital and it creates a whole that I think is larger than the sum of the parts, gives founders agency to change things and to adapt And one of my other hobby horses recently is talking about Facebook. And I wrote a blog post recently about Facebook and why I think Mark Zuckerberg might be all the things that the media popularize him as. But, you know, I think I'm certainly not going to bet against him.
Now, capital's key for these innovators. Can you speak more of the role of the bank or the broker's effect on the cost of capital for a company and their market value?
Yeah, okay. So I wrote a blog post last year sometime entitled Obliquity and Successful Children, which is based on ideas that I borrowed from John Kay, who wrote a book called Obliquity, which I think is a great read. And really, it sort of explores two related ideas. One is that a lot of, and maybe most, technical innovation is the indirect result of the effort applied, not the direct result. And that successful companies become successful via their ability to adapt. And I think one area where investors can capture real value is looking at companies that succeed their corporate parents. So what do I mean by that? So in the post, I asked, coming back to PayPal, but you know it applies to other companies. So what do PayPal, Aggreko, and Howden Joinery all have in common was the question I posed. And they're all, of course, very successful businesses in their own respective fields. But they're also the children of bigger companies that were let free and spun out and allowed to grow, and in all cases, became much bigger than the parent companies that they were spun out from. And there's lots of reasons why this is an interesting and workable strategy to look at these type of companies. But I'd say the main reason in the short term is that these companies were never IPO'd. And this comes back to your question about the role of intermediaries in the valuation of businesses. And these spin-out companies, these successful children, were the return that you gained was partly as a result of the fact that they were never marketed by the syndicates of investment banks that extract the last drop of value from a deal in a new issue or an IPO, such as would be applied to a traditional IPO from a private equity-backed business. And I guess over the years I worked in the industry, you know, there's a reason why some of the cleverest and shrewdest operators I worked with worked in equity syndication and capital markets, because their main job, value add, was to work out the strategies and the tactics of how to extract the maximum value on a new issue transaction. And these people command big fees because they add a lot of value to the process. So flipping that on its head, how do I take advantage of that? One example I would point to in the market today is that of Wix. Now, Wix has recently demerged from Travis Perkins. It's a very solid business. It used to be a quoted entity. It had quite a good reputation. It, you know, had a period of good management and then not so good management. It was acquired by Travis Perkins and now it's been spun out. It's a solid business. It's got a strong place in the market and sort of trade and semi-pro DIY and what they call the do-it-for-me home improvement space. But its journey is characterized to the stock market. It's essentially by falling into the laps of its existing Travis Perkins shareholders. It wasn't pre-sold or pre-positioned in any particular way. And we don't know yet. It hasn't had time to prove itself. But my guess is that as an independent entity, Wix will begin to thrive as capital and management attention is focused more deeply into the business and the issues it faces. One thing I can say for sure is if you look at the valuation metrics of Wix today, you cannot tell me that any corporate broker or investment bank worth his salt out there would pitch that valuation to a private equity company and say, I can get you this value for your business, because they wouldn't get the mandate. So I think it's important to understand that the intermediaries in this process can affect valuation in the short term. What's the saying about weighing machines and voting machines that have been used to talk about the valuation in the market? But in the short term, the intermediaries process, the role of banks and brokers, can impact the valuation of a business. And, you know, to come back to this theme of successful children and companies that have emerged into the market by ways other than the valuation event of an IPO, you know, I think is a really interesting hunting ground. One of my favorite investments of all time is a company called 4imprint. And it was effectively, it is, the orphaned only child of the former check printing company called Bemrose Corporation, which is no longer. And just like Howden Joinery as well, which was the orphaned child of the now defunct furniture retailer MFI. Both of these companies have not only become, you know, £1 billion plus scale businesses with successful in their own right, but they've also assumed and paid off the former pension liabilities of their parents. So by any classification, who wouldn't want to have children like these?
And do you think today that companies are less long-term viewing in that they're looking for the short-term return to satisfy shareholders and therefore they take short-term decisions?
I don't know is the short answer, but I think there's a clearer distinction than ever in my own mind about the attractiveness of owner-managed businesses or businesses that display this owner mindset. You know, I think one of the most positive features of the UK economy in recent years is the rate of new business formation, which I think has been running at high level for a number of years, and I think reached record proportions during lockdown. I guess the question is, how many of these new businesses find their way onto the listed stock markets? I don't have any numbers for that, but clearly we've had a period for the last year or so of accelerated rate of IPOs, of new companies coming to the market. And I can think of a few off the top of my head, you know, like Microlise, Victorian Plumbing, Active Ops, which are genuinely interesting owner-managed businesses, founder-led. And I like these type of businesses because the presence of an owner, manager, or a founder, or a family indeed, reduces what is the asymmetric risk that's normally associated with this agency principle problem of investing in public markets. Nassim Taleb wrote a great book called Skin in the Game, and he showed that all successful adaptive systems that thrive have skin in the game. I mean, life itself is a classic example. We are, you know, literally we have our own skin in the game, and we are the result of exactly this type of successful adaptive system. And Taleb said that asymmetry in risk bearing leads to imbalances and potentially to systemic ruin. And that doesn't just apply to companies, but it definitely does apply to companies. You know, we talked about, and we all know about, these positive attributes to look for in businesses. You know, the moats, the high margins, the strong rates of reinvestment, all these good things to look for. But what can we do to minimize the risk of poor executions? You know, things going wrong, you know, outright fraud or systematic ruin. Well, simply put, the management of a company with a large equity holding aligns itself with other shareholders more accurately than one that does not. And hired hand chief executives and management teams, you don't have that. There are many studies that show that family-controlled and founder-led businesses are just better longer-term custodians and more prudent allocators of shareholder capital than agency, just regular hired-hand agency management teams. And that, you know, from my personal experience of working with companies in the stock market, you just notice a tendency, a greater obsession with short-term movements in a share price from those CEOs who don't really have much skin in the game. Maybe they have LTIPs or, you know, some option-based rewards, but the real owner managers, the people who live and breathe their companies, they don't really care about what happens to their share price on a day-to-day or a week-to-week basis. They're too busy running their company and taking long-term decisions. So LTIPs, not so much for me. You know, maybe a necessary evil, but it's not skin in the game.
So coming back to where you're investing today, are you going for value or are you going for growth?
Interesting question. What has become known as value and growth, I think, are branches of the same religion. So you could ask me who was right, the Protestants or the Catholics. And to answer that question, I guess you could sort of ask, you know, which investor out there doesn't believe when they're buying something, they aren't buying something of value. So, and the reality is both styles of investing have their flaws. You know, value investing is a good way of buying cheap typewriter companies, also known as value traps. And growth investors, by the same token, have got a tendency, a predisposition to new ways of thinking, and they have a tendency to get sucked into bubbles or even frauds such as Wirecard or Enron. You know, value investors' stance is one of overt skepticism, if not cynicism, whereas growth investors are looking for the upside. They're more prepared to engage in blue sky, new paradigm thinking. So Warren Buffett, you know, described his approach to value investing in the 1940s as cigar butt investing. You know, in the aftermath of the Great Depression, World War II, offered a huge array of unresearched shares in companies that traded at significant discounts to book value, low multiples of sales and earnings, had all the characteristic that Benjamin Graham talked about, and held the view, quite correctly as it turned out, that these businesses would return to their higher intrinsic value. And it turned out to be the case. So the value fundamentalist sees this period, the heyday of value investing, as the norm or the way the world should be. But I think there are many reasons why this was an exceptional period of time and that history, the world has moved on. And the reality is that since the days of Benjamin Graham, the world has changed dramatically. You know, the economy and its financial markets were in those days were seen as component parts to this equilibrium-seeking, rotating machine in a Keynesian world. The world is now a very different place. And I think it's interesting, much more recently, I think it was recently last year, one of the modern-day flag bearers for value investing, Howard Marks, has basically made an acknowledgement that this sort of rulebook approach to value investing, as epitomized by Benjamin Graham, has lost its effect. And he made in one of his famous investment newsletters last year, made seven assertions on value, which I think were all very interesting and worth, if you don't mind, worth just repeating. And the first one is that value investing doesn't have to be about low value metrics. Many sources of potential value cannot be reduced to a number, which I think is really interesting. Qualitative judgments are often more important than quantitative ones. Well, who'd have guessed? Rapid growth is not necessarily unpredictable. A high valuation doesn't mean overvalued. Rapid growth is often underpriced. And the final one, which I think is the most important, the impact of compound growth is powerful and always surprising. Now, each of these points in order is a concession, in my opinion, that the old model of Benjamin Graham no longer applies. Rather than conforming to a mechanistic school of classical economic equilibrium and mean reversion, the modern economy today has more affinity, in my opinion, to what I would describe as an organic, complex, adaptive system that has evolved in a manner of self-replication and adaptation. I guess to come back to the point of value versus growth, you know, the best investment to have is one that you buy as a value company on the value metrics, and it transforms itself into a growth stock. And, you know, if this happens, this can be hugely rewarding. And one way this happens is by luck. But another way this happens is to use the tactics adopted by activists to shake up sleepy management teams, to sell off their unwanted or underperforming subsidiaries, children, and reinvigorate the strategy. And I think, you know, a previous guest on your show, Stuart Widdowson, is doing exactly that, or a form of that, at Odyssean. And I think it's really interesting. And another approach is to build your own growth companies, which Gary Channon is doing at Phoenix, where they're repurposing old economy direct-to-consumer value companies or consumer-facing value companies into the modern ways of e-commerce. So they're building growth from value. So I guess to be difficult, I don't think that the value and growth descriptors are actually that helpful. I don't think that the divisions and the distinctions between these different schools of thought are going to disappear anytime soon. But, you know, I think there are alternative ways or alternative decision-making frameworks to consider. One that I've come across quite recently, actually, is some work based on some of the thinking done by IBM in the 1990s. And it's called the QN-FIN framework. And in essence, this comes down to identifying that all decision making is undertaken in one of four frameworks. And these are simple, complicated, complex, or chaotic. And the first three of these broadly align with what Donald Rumsfeld made famous in his scenarios of known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. So a simple system involves decision that is a common sense one or strictly procedural. So such as think of a loan underwriting decision. It can be done by algorithm. As you advance, you get to a complicated system. And this is about a decision made in an environment of known unknowns. So think about you're driving your car and there's a knocking sound. You know it's coming from the engine, but you don't know how to fix it. You need an expert. You need assistance to solve it. And the next stage is a complex system. And this involves emergent outcomes from complexity that is fundamentally unknowable and one that is truly an unknown unknown. So think of a weather system or an ant colony, the universe or the human body. We're all complex adaptive systems. And Taleb makes a distinction between a rabbit and a refrigerator. One is complicated. You can deconstruct it. A refrigerator, you can work out how it works by taking it to bits. You can't understand a rabbit by taking it to bits. Its emergent behavior is unknowable. And I think that is the journey that our financial markets and our economy is on. We've moved from the complicated, where most of the problems are known unknowns. That's the world that Warren Buffett was familiar with. And we've moved on to unknown unknowns, to a complex environment. And this may be a better way, I think, of investing, of thinking about investment opportunities. And one of the conclusions for this rather rambling assertion is that what we should look for are companies and investment opportunities, but companies that are resilient and adaptable. And I wrote about this in the context of Facebook, now Meta, in a recent blog post, that you want financial strength combined with long tail optionality. And that is how you survive and eventually thrive in a complex decision-making environment.
Tremendous. Thank you very much indeed. Now, I know you've just launched the podcast series In the Company of Mavericks. Can you tell us a bit about it and why you've done it?
Yeah, sure. I guess last year during lockdown, really just as a, you know, an aid memoir, just a way of structuring my own thoughts, I started writing a blog, which is called Hypernormal Times. And it was just, there was a lot going on and I was trying to sort out my own thoughts about from largely a macro perspective, what was going on in the world. And I started publishing it on LinkedIn and then had my own website and, you know, which I enjoyed. But what I really missed or really what I realized that I, you know, the thing I really loved in the time I was working in institutional broking was meeting and working with entrepreneurial businesses and the people behind them. And I sort of became fascinated by the journeys that these people took and the problems they were looking to solve by starting their businesses. And over the years, been lucky to work with some really interesting businesses and some really fascinating entrepreneurs. And more recently, working with Ben and the team at Dowgate Wealth, you know, I've been able to continue that sort of journey of meeting companies as they come to market, having meetings with company on their normal rounds with institutional meetings. And I just wanted to allow some of these stories to be made more widely available. Yeah, I think as working in institutional investment is working in wealth management as I do today, yeah, we're very fortunate to be able to meet and work with some very clever people. And, you know, I think you've done a brilliant job with PI World and some of the people you've interviewed, like Christopher Mills and Rosemary Banyard, Stuart Widdowson, are great examples of this. So I just wanted to share the story. And I think there's, as well as getting the, well, rather I think than just getting the investment case across, helping people understand some of the personal journey and the raison d'etre for these businesses and the problems they're looking to solve and maybe some of the issues they faced along the way. And these journeys are not sort of bottom left to top right in that they change. And, you know, people have setbacks and how people deal with and adapt to those changes, I think is fascinating. And I think it's really important, and hopefully to encourage other people to who may be working in the larger companies or looking to start out in life to maybe launch their own business. And who knows, you know, maybe I'll get the opportunity to interview them on my podcast. So yeah, we're two episodes in. We launched the second one today. The first was with James Crawford of Naked Wines. The second one, which I launched today, was with Sukh Chamdal, who's the CEO and founder of Cakebox. And we've got another one in the works with Alistair Haynes of Aquis. So exciting, very enjoyable. And I think other people listen to it because my mum's told me that she's listened to the first episode.
Tremendous. Well, we'll look forward to listening to those. And tell people where they can find you.
Okay, I'm on LinkedIn, Jeremy McEwen on LinkedIn. You can find me at my blog website, which is hypernormaltimes, all one word, .com. Or my podcast website, which is in a shocking state of disrepair right now, but in the company of mavericks.com. And you can find me on the website of Dowgate Wealth as well.
Well, thank you so much, Jeremy. And to our listeners, please leave comments on the various social media platforms as it helps us get the very best speakers. To subscribe to receive a notification of a new video as it's published with no spam, go to piworld.co.uk on the top right-hand side. Click on the subscribe button. Many thanks for listening and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.